Welcome to another PID webinar. We are trying very hard to keep our eye on the local economy and trying to learn as much as we can. Quite frankly, there are too many subjects that are left under-researched in our country. Today, we are going to take up the subject of public health. I know we are in the middle of the COVID crisis, and everybody is thinking of just solving the COVID problem without worrying about the larger national health problem. So we at PID would like to retain some sort of an eye while keeping an eye on COVID, but also keep some sort of an eye on the systems that are at work, because after all, our response to a public health crisis like COVID or our response to any other issue will depend on the kind of systems that we have in place. So we would like to learn, we are economists, we don't know enough about these issues. So we would like to learn about the public health system, write about them and examine these public health system from the point of view, can we have a better system? And that is a question that we will put before our speaker, Dr. Sami Altaf. Dr. Sami Altaf is a well-known public health specialist, actually a doctor first. She became a doctor, then chose to do public health. So she's both a doctor, as an internist, as well as a public health specialist. She has worked not only in Pakistan, she's worked overseas. She was in Stanford. She's worked in the California health system. She's worked in the DC health system. So she knows the international health system. She also knows about the Pakistani health system. She's worked in the Pakistani health system. She's written a lovely book called So Little Aid, So Little Development, which was like a critique of the public health system in Pakistan and the USAID intervention in that health system. But the question that we want to put to Samia is to explain to us, what sort of system do we have? I know that most of us come into contact with the health system when we are looking for a doctor. Then we find the nearest doctor and we go to him, pay him a fee or pay her a fee. And otherwise there are hospitals. Again, there are private hospitals and public hospitals. But this is for those of us who can afford it. What about those who can't afford it? Then public health is much more than hospitals. And Samia knows more than I do about this. And there are so many issues in public health, ranging from sanitation to food to primary care to issues that concern economists like us, the cost of healthcare, which unfortunately, or whatever you might say, which no country in the world is able to contend with. The US is crumbling under the healthcare cost. Europe is crumbling under healthcare cost. So healthcare is a complex economic issue that economists are struggling with too. But let us try and understand from Samia what our healthcare system is, what it should be, because she'll give us a global experience too. She'll tell us what the DC and other health systems are like, and what are the key issues there that we, the rest of us who are concerned with the public health system from a policy viewpoint, should look at. So Samia, with that introduction, over to you. The floor is yours. Please speak. One thing I'd only say, I got a call from the ADB. They said that, you know, they were listening to the webinar and we are speaking in Urdu. So today I've tried to deliberately speak in English. I am, unless there are no foreigners, maybe we can, but they listen to it on YouTube too. So maybe we should do it in English for a while, just to keep our donors on.
Sure. Thank you very much, Nadeem. Thank you, Saima, for working with me over the past couple of weeks to bring this here for us now. And thanks to PID for this very kind invitation. You know, I'm a physician, as Nadeem said, and a specialist in preventive medicine and in public health. I have spent most of my professional life practicing in the healthcare industry at all levels and in all areas. So I have worked in policy, in program design, in evaluation, in monitoring. I worked as a clinician in community clinics, and also as an academic teaching medical and nursing students in Aga Khan Medical College. I have worked, as Nadeem again said, in US, in Pakistan, in India, Indonesia, and in the Palestine territories. And I, during this time, I've had the opportunity to work with people at all levels and with very different backgrounds, you know, from ministers and senior bureaucrats and policymakers to community health workers to, you know, mom and pop service providers in Washington, D.C., to medical nursing students, and interacted very closely and worked with my own peers. So it's been a wide-based experience, and I will share with you what I've learned about health systems in general and about the Pakistan's health system in particular during all these meanderings. And hopefully we'll be able to, you know, find some basic points that will help us understand and go forward. So during this this talk, I'm going to make about four or five larger points, and then leave time for questions and answers and discussion, because I find a very wide-ranging audience with wide-ranging skills. You know, the first basic point and the main point is that in all countries, the way the health services are organized and personnel trained to deliver those services depend on the perspectives regarding the world of healthcare. That decision depends upon the country's perspective regarding the world of healthcare. One perspective is that of individual as the unit of concern, and the other is the perspective of the overall system as a unit of concern. Which out of these two the policymakers focus on determines the trajectory of service delivery system and ultimately the results as captured by the critical health indicators. You know, if the system as a unit is healthy, it keeps most of the individuals healthy most of the time and makes it easy to care for those few who become sick and need medical services. If the larger system is sick, you know, many more individuals get sick, doctors treat them, and then send them back to the sick system, and so this cycle continues. Each of these perspectives, either the individual as a unit or the system as a unit, obviously prioritizes different attitudes in policymakers and encourages different policies and different actions. Those countries that prioritize the system invest to make it healthy by investing in clean air, in water, clean water, in sanitation. They invest in education, in housing, in nutrition, and in proactive preventive health services. They incentivize the providers of such services so that professionals find these career choices attractive. And so the communities are kept healthy and they need minimum amount of medical care. You know, countries that prioritize individual care, on the other hand, without any concern for the larger system, invest in doctors with more and more specializations, and invest in hospitals, as has been done in Pakistan. The doctors in the hospitals then keep to this Sisyphusian task of curing the sick, you know, again and again through a revolving door with not very good results. The second point that I understood is that the privatization of healthcare services is not a good idea. The evidence for that is before us in the form of New York's inability to cope with the COVID epidemic. You know, even a healthy system as one in US, where, you know, basic clean water and sanitation is available, shows that the system was not able to cope with the COVID epidemic. You know, even a healthy system like that cannot cope with such an outlier as a COVID epidemic, for privatization will not let resources sit idle. And so in an emergency, resources are not available to deal with that. Privatization, in my view, is not even good for routine services, because citizens as buyers of health services from the market are not informed consumers. They do not make the decision as to which product they want, and they do not are not able to return the product if they are not satisfied with it. The next point that I want to make is that the focus on health budget all over the world, in all the countries, wherever you go, you know, they talk about the health budget. And certainly in Pakistan is a big issue. I feel that this focus on health budgets as the panacea for improvements in services is not very meaningful or very helpful. You know, there are countries like United States that spends almost 18% of its GDP on healthcare. I believe, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that this is probably the highest in the world. And on the other hand, you have countries like Finland and Denmark. Denmark spends about 10% of its GDP on its health budget, and Finland about 9%. And you find that their critical indicators, many of their critical indicators, are much better than that of the United States. You know, this the health budget discussion in Pakistan, especially in my view, is a red herring. You know, where you can see that about 60% of the existing budget, you know, meager enough as it is unutilized during the fiscal year. And that has happened almost every year for the last 20 years that I've been following it. The fourth point that I want to make is that, this is a very critical point, because it has to do with implementation of health services, that local public health service delivery systems managed and administered at the community level are, in my view, the key to keeping the larger systems healthy. And I've seen evidence of that around the world. You know, communities know and see these workers every day working around them, from around the corner from them, and see them, you know, invested in the larger well-being of the communities. You also see, I seem to have lost my, here I am. So this policy of having community workers establish their practices in the community, and government health services in the community, creates a kind of a holistic wellness system. And it's quite easy to organize this system by incentivizing staff to deliver preventive health services, to deliver environment health services, to deliver health education services, to communicate, you know, behavior change to the local population. And these people can be incentivized to do that, just as doctors are incentivized when there is an individual-based focus to go and work in disadvantaged areas. We have also found recently, and even earlier than this recent epidemic, that such local systems are extremely helpful in combating epidemics, which are acute and new ones like the COVID, or old ones like the epidemics that are coming along with us for many, many years now, for example, that of tuberculosis. You know, they are useful and helpful because community trusts these workers who've been there, and these workers in turn know the community and its vulnerabilities. They know, you know, which household has what kind of a problem. This knowledge gives these workers enormous credibility. That is why communities listen to them, and their messages are trusted over that of ministers who speak on TV, or federal workers who, during an emergency, distribute paper pamphlets around the villages. We can also see there's evidence in front of us right now, if you look around, that countries that have set up such systems, which work at local levels, are faring better in coping with the current epidemic. For example, look at Sri Lanka. You know, Sri Lankan government credits its local system for helping to contain the epidemic. You know, within countries, for example, in India, there are different states who are much better off in terms of their local governments than other states. For example, Kerala, and those states have done much better in dealing with the epidemic, and it looks like they will continue to do so. Even in places where those systems were not established historically, but were established at the time of the epidemic, the results were very good. For example, in the slum called, there's a slum called Dharvi, right outside of Mumbai. Incidentally, this slum was the setting for that famous movie, Slumdog Millionaire. So Dharvi is basically a slum of 100 million people. And they were able to work, the local doctors in that slum were able to work with local community workers to contain the epidemic when the it was completely raging outside in other areas, Mumbai and other areas of India. Here in this slum, what they did was that the community workers, because they were known to the community, and the community trusted them, they convinced the work community members to get tested and to get isolated. So within 1 week, they were able to test 47,000 people, and they found that out of those, 20% were infected. They were able to isolate those infected people, quarantine the ones that they needed to quarantine. And in addition to that, they carried out health education activities in the local vernacular and in many different languages, because the slum contains a migrant population that came from different areas of India. Although at that time, because India had closed down, almost 100,000 of the migrant labor that lived in that slum had gone back, but there was still, you know, a substantial number. So results speak for themselves. So out of 1 million residents of that slum, only 2,000 had infections and 79, there were only 79 deaths. These are far fewer deaths than in Mumbai. So these are my four basic points that are basically set up the framework in which I am also going to be looking at Pakistan. So if all of us know, I don't have to reiterate that, but Pakistan, we all know, has a system of healthcare that is completely unresponsive to the needs of majority of its citizens. And it has been so for the past so many decades. So it is no surprise today that the system finds itself completely unable to cope with the COVID crisis. It is because Pakistan has prioritized care of the individual over that of creating a healthy system. You know, you see that in recent years, over the past almost 10, 15 years, the numbers of medical colleges, the number of doctors, and the number of hospitals have been increased many times. Now the medical colleges are being changed into medical universities that have a capacity to recruit many more number of people to be trained and educated. Despite all these doctors and hospitals, the country can do very little about the continuous silent epidemics that are raging all the time in parallel. These are those of hepatitis, tuberculosis, diabetes, hypertension, and cancers. In spite of all these doctors and hospitals, people are still dying in corridors of hospitals, waiting for beds or waiting for doctors to come see them. The larger critical health indicators have not improved much either. Many of these, such as under 5 mortality rate, maternal mortality ratios, and patient to doctor ratios, remain amongst the poorest in the region. And one indicator, one critical indicator, the neonatal mortality rate, is poorest in the whole world. You know, Pakistan, unfortunately, is number one in neonatal mortality rates since 2018. What I find very dismaying, because I've been involved with this business for so many years now and seen this cycle repeated again and again, and what dismays me very much is that policymakers do not seem to learn from what really needs to be done. For one, you know, at least they can learn that not only do you need to produce specialist doctors, because there's a large volume of disease, and this is an individual disease-based system. So yes, you need to produce large specialist doctors, but you also need system specialists. For example, epidemiologists, virologists, you know, specialists in preventive medicine. specialists in health education in diffusion of information, which are basically the cornerstones of public health programs. You know, I asked myself this question: where is the Pakistan's Institute of Epidemiology? You know, Pakistan doesn't have professional epidemiologists, it doesn't have professional virologists. It should incentivize professionals. When I speak to policymakers, they say, well, you know, nobody is interested in these fields. People are not interested in these fields because there is no incentive, you know, attached to going into these fields. There is no work environment, there's no financial rewards, there is no professional satisfaction. So Pakistan should incentivize professionals to go into these fields so that they can help build up a healthy system over a period of time. But Pakistan does not do so because its priorities is individual care. Pakistan's investment in creating a healthy system is also abysmal. Close to 45% of its children suffer from malnutrition, and many are permanently stunted. 45% of the population has no access to water. And that frustrates me very much. I ask myself this question, why? You know, when the technology for providing clean water is simple and available, and it was here in this region 5,000 years ago. I mean, you look at Mohenjo-daro, you know, the aqueducts and all of that, you know, it was right there. So the sanitation situation is also nothing to be proud of. You know, 12% of Pakistan's population, that is almost 25 million people each day, still practice open defecation. In certain places, such as villages in Tharparkar, 95% of the population defecates in the open. It is no wonder that Tharparkar's children suffer from continuous diarrheas, continuous pneumonias, and continuous skin infections. These are, of course, treated very heroically in pediatric intensive care units of Karachi's hospitals. And then these children are sent back to the same Tharparkar again. While policymakers speak loud and long about setting up government committees to bring about reforms. We've seen that cycle repeated every year, you know, for the past so many years, whichever government is in power. I will alert my friends here to recall that, you know, whenever people talk about reforms, I'm reminded when our policymakers talk about reforms in response to health problems created by poor sanitation, I am reminded of the health reform in England, which was basically an urban sanitation reform, started in 1838. It was spearheaded by doctors who were tired of treating children with diarrheas and with skin infections who were living in tenement housing. So the question I ask myself, you know, whenever I see this is how difficult it is to make latrines. Why is it so difficult for Pakistan to do that? Certainly it should be a lot easier than making fancy hospitals. You know, other countries have done it. They've built latrines. Even poor little Bangladesh did it, and it has brought its open defecation rate from 42% in 2003 to 1% in 2018, with concomitant decrease in childhood mortality rates. The issue of local health service systems is you know, very close to my heart, and Nadeem and I have talked about it many times. And I find it very unfortunate that even in spite of having an extensive network of health facilities, you know, and quite a fairly robust district administration system, Pakistan has not been in the last 72 years able to build a local public health or health services system. You know, there are district hospitals and tehsil hospitals and rural health centers and basic health units that have inroads into far-flung local communities. You know, all these centers and these hospitals have designated staff assigned to them by the provincial health departments. Well, at least on paper, you know, they have that staff. But the reality is that you find that all these centers are empty and non-functional. And then what do people do? Of course, people, when they get sick in the living around the those areas, they have no choice but to run to the city hospitals. You know, even the doctors sitting in these hospitals, district hospitals and tehsil hospitals, say that when we have a patient with a chest pain or, you know, whatever, we have no means of evaluating them. We tell them ourselves, go take your patient to the city. Don't bring that person here. So people go to the city hospitals, which are already overburdened with problems that they could have been easily dealt with at the periphery without those problems morphing into much more serious and critical problems that require more resources and have a lot poorer outcomes. I will say this over here, that vaccinations drives is one of the services, preventive health services, that is provided in rural areas. Vaccination in the form of vaccination drives. So there are vaccination drives which are conducted every few months for communicable disease control in children. And of course, the most famous is the polio eradication drive. These are organized and managed and implemented not by the local government, not by the provincial government, but by the federal government. So the results are before us. Pakistan continues to harbor the polio virus in spite of millions of dollars of investment and, you know, 2 decades worth of effort. For other communicable diseases, the vaccine coverage at best is no more than 50%, which is way below one needed for herd immunity, which is why, unfortunately, in this 21st century, you see in districts just 50 miles from a city like Lahore, children dying with diphtheria and children dying with whooping cough. You know, things that we had thought were diseases of the last century. The communication strategies also of these vaccination drives are organized from central program authorities. Or if we want to make them still better, they are designed by international experts. So the effect is going to be the effect that it has. I have just completed a year conducting research in immunization issues from demand side and supply side in Kasur district, which is not very far from Lahore. And it is quite fascinating that it is like you go into these villages just around Kasur city, and you find that you've come on another planet. Of course, parents over there say that they will not let these vaccinators come inside their houses. They don't trust them at all. These are government workers. They say they are asking us how many children we have. And that means that they are going to institute family planning programs, or they are going to, you know, put taxes on us or those kind of things. So there's a huge lack of trust of the federal authorities. And again, you know, this research, we have shown that in our research. By the way, this research was funded by a very, very dynamic organization called the Shalimar Shahid Hussain Foundation, that also runs the Shalimar Hospital. And my co-partner on that research was a LUMS professor in political science, Sameen Mohsin Ali. So I get very dismayed. And I say, well, you know, if Pakistan cannot think for itself, you know, we are constantly embroiled in turmoils and in you know, disputes and, you know, all kinds of things and natural disasters. So maybe we don't have time to think for ourselves. But why cannot Pakistan learn from experience of other countries? You know, we are so good at importing the culture of other countries, which is very nice. I'm all for that. But at the same time, we can learn good things also. For example, Sri Lanka has a well-organized local service delivery system, which I said before was of critical help in containing the COVID epidemic. Again, I will bring the example of Bangladesh, which has managed to build these local community-based administrative systems. And those systems have allowed it to surpass even Pakistan in almost all health indicators, in spite of Bangladesh's very difficult history and its very challenging circumstances that are, you know, quite as bad, its internal circumstances, quite as bad as that of Pakistan's or any other developing country. Bangladesh was actually able to eradicate polio in 5 years when they made the decision that they will eradicate polio, and they participated in the global polio eradication program. They undertook certain policy decisions backed up by money that helped them eradicate the disease within 5 years. That's what they said they would do. They would eradicate it in 5 years. And they have been polio-free since 2014. Evaluators attribute this success to Bangladesh's extensive community-based preventive health programs. Especially in communicable disease control, Bangladesh's efforts to increase female education rates, and the local strategies it used to empower local women, because local women were the main health educators and vaccinators who went around and vaccinated kids. So my point is that, you know, there is evidence before us that these things can be done, however poor the country is and however difficult its internal circumstances are. It can be done, provided there is, you know, competent and serious leadership. In Pakistan, I also say that financing and budgetary issues are a big mystery. You know, they are not discussed at all while making policy. Actually, even policy issues are barely discussed. You know, I keep asking myself this question: why is this such a mystery? You know, these are public policy discussions. These are public policy issues. These should be in the public domain. We, the public, should be able to see what the policymakers are talking about, either in the assembly or in other forum, or the government departments like Planning Commission or whoever make these plans should make available the documents that say what they're doing. You know, even the on the budget issue again, you know, if there's a chronic problem of underutilization, but it seems that there is no investigation of why that is a problem and what are the corrective measures that we can take to fix that, so that in coming years we have good justification to ask for an enhanced budget. To me, it seems that the government is just content to finance health services on the side through charity. For example, large hospitals like Shaukat Khanam, like Sindh Institute of Urological Technology, and like the Indus chain of hospitals. You know, all of these, God bless them, do very good work. But you know, that's not how governments are supposed to respond to healthcare. And on the other hand, the government is content to have donors fund their many vertical health programs, the polio program, the malaria program, the reproductive health program, the TB program, through donor funding. And then they use that money to train staff to build capacity. And this staff, after many technical workshops in fancy hotels or study trips to Harvard, do not bring about any improvements. So be the staff, you know, community health workers or government officials, it's exactly the same situation. So to me, it seems that in Pakistan, it's really free for all. You know, those of us who have the money and the means to buy healthcare from the few private hospitals who want to sell this product, and we can buy it, we are fine. But it looks like but even those hospitals are not well regulated and not well monitored. So we when we go to buy this product from these hospitals, are basically on our own. So it seems that there is no one in charge of reviewing problems in the health sector, analyzing these problems within the context of the challenges and the conditions of our own country, and then proposing solutions. Then those solutions need to be debated, they need to be budgeted, and then the activities should be designed and implemented through a collaborative effort with provincial governments monitoring them, with federal governments providing guidance and oversight. I am, you know, Nadeem knows that, and I've raised this issue many times on this SPIDE webinars. You know, I have been searching and trying to find out where and how decisions are made, but there is very little documentation available. Of course, you know, there are pronouncements by government officials once in a while on TV, or, you know, things written in the newspaper, but I'm talking about actually documentation of government plans. Such as very few are available. Such is also the case for government's COVID response. You know, the National COVID Response Strategy, which has a date of March, I think 12 or 13, is basically no strategy at all. It is only a cut and paste of international guidelines. So what are we to make of what the government is thinking and what it is doing and which direction it wants to go? And those of us who have a little bit of knowledge and a little bit of ability and who can make some suggestions, you know, how do we do that? Where do we do that? And yet, at the same time, the government carries on about the rhetoric of reform. So in my opinion, it seems that this should be the starting point for system reform in Pakistan. Government's health policy plans for routine services, and certainly for any system reform, should be shared with civil society. These should be in the public domain. Any advice that the government takes from international agencies should be public information. You know, I have spent the past almost 1 week trying to find out what advice did the Chinese team give to the government's COVID team, because, you know, they said earlier on that we are taking advice from Chinese who have had very good experience. You know, I can understand the government not wanting to share any CPEC-related information with the citizens, because it is, I suppose, classified information, though over there also somebody like me, you know, is a taxpayer citizen, taxpaying citizen, say, why the hell not? But certainly in healthcare, you know, what advice did the Chinese give? What kind of information did they share? Which out of all the recommendations that the Chinese team had made, which recommendations did the government take? And how did they implement them? So civil society members should be allowed to comment on that, should be allowed to review that. I will stop here. I won't not give the many details of the history of the system, because I think that it is probably better if we have more an open discussion. But I will say this in the end, that it seems to me that even at this point, if we want to bring about any change, or if we want to, kind of nudge the COVID response in some coherent, cohesive direction, then this information needs to be made available to us. So I will stop here. Thank you very much for being a very patient audience.
Thank you, Samia. Thank you. I think that is very useful. But Samia, I mean, there's lots of stuff that you shared, which is very important, that we must make a conceptual view of the system, think about what we are trying to achieve, what our objectives are. Our objectives ultimately should be the well-being of the citizens and society as a whole. And we can take an individual perspective or a systemic perspective. I come from the neoclassical economic school of thought. So I do believe that the individual should take a larger role in healthcare responsibilities. But I also see the community aspect that you're talking about. But let's sort of simplify it and ask you a very simple question. Supposing today you were appointed, just, you know, we economists do a lot of assumption thinking, right? So I can wave my wand and say, assume you are the health czar of Pakistan going forward from today. What advice would you give? You tell me that, yes, we have all the systems in place. We've got health units, we've got lady health workers, we've got hospitals even in the basic health units in tehsils, etc. We've got district health hospitals, you know, we oversupply doctors go to the civil service. So we seem to have everything in place, but somehow we can't seem to put the system together. So if you were the health czar, as I placed you there by assumption, what systemic changes would you consider? Especially given the implementation has taken over as well.
Nadeem, you have put me on the spot here. But you know, if today what needs to be taken care of, like we do in clinical medicine, the emergency is first priority. So the emergency today is the COVID epidemic and doing something about it. So knowing what I know about the COVID epidemic based upon research from other countries and information gathered, that is where I would concentrate. I would pull together a team of experts from all the provinces, you know, the technical experts, people in public health. There are many good public health people in Pakistan. One is my good friend and colleague, Talat Rizvi, who is on this website. She has many years of experience in public in working and teaching in public health. So there are many people like her, pulled together public health experts, policy experts, quantitative analytical experts, and politicians and bureaucrats. And with their help, design a strategy that a COVID strategy that basically does two things. It reduces the harm to the citizens. So if that is your objective, then what you need to do is, given where COVID is at this time, you need to identify vulnerabilities, the vulnerable populations and vulnerable institutions. Vulnerable populations, most vulnerable populations are doctors and frontline workers right now, and people who are 60 and above and have comorbidities. So et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to go into the details of all of that. So that is the first thing I would do. I would come up with an implementation plan and involve the district health authorities. For example, there are district hospitals most district hospitals have medical superintendents of the hospitals. And those are people who have worked there for many, many years. They are very experienced. They know what is missing in this hospital and what can be fixed very quickly to make this hospital work. So I would co-opt those people and ask them to make their hospitals function. I would ask the provincial governments to release the funds, to ask the provincial assembly to pass special waivers, to give special permissions to the government to release funds and to make emergency appointments to recruit more people. For example, the frontline doctors are working long hours and without any relief. You know, you have 15,000 final year medical students in Pakistan. I would ask the government and the legislators to allow us to recruit these people as doctors, give them emergency registration or whatever needs to be done, and incentivize them to come forward and start working. I would organize, short-term 3 to 4 days training programs so those people are trained very quickly to at least to basic level and mid-level clinical work so that your trained clinicians are free to take care of the people in the hospital. I would make sure that the burden on the hospitals, city hospitals that have ventilators and that have critical care abilities should be decreased so that much more of the isolation and the quarantine should be done in the periphery. I would put together a team that basically pulls together a plan of behavior modification, because to control this epidemic, the major public health principle is that you require behavior modification in your public. You see how difficult behavior modification is, that well, 3 or 4, almost 12 weeks into the epidemic, you know, even the senior health officials who are talking about distancing and who are talking about masks were not wearing masks and were not practicing social distancing. It's not that they were doing it, they were forgetting or they were doing it deliberately. it just goes to show that modifying your behavior is very difficult. One of the federal ministers is on record in one of the TV program talk shows that the host said that, you know, he had seen you, this minister, he said, I've seen you shaking hands with people. And this minister said, yes, I'm really sorry because, you know, this is our habit. So changing old habits to something new requires a lot of effort, especially in a country like Pakistan, where the public has very little, people have very little trust in the government. You know, Singapore, was it Singapore or Taiwan, when they announced a lockdown, you know, most of these countries, people participate wholeheartedly because they trust the government. You know, they feel that the government is on our side. So if I was the czar, you know, I would start with that. But at the same time, I would start reorganizing I hate to use the word reform. I think that's not a very useful word. It's too pretentious and too ostentatious. But I would start organizing the health services system to start caring for the most vulnerable. You know, Prime Minister Imran Khan also in his maiden speech talked about women who are dying in childbirth, you know, obstetrical emergencies. He talked about children under five who are dying of infectious diseases. And he said those are the priority of his government. But he said that and went home and that's it. I would really put in service systems that prioritize those. For example, if you say, what service system? You know, this discussion is going to get very long. I don't know if you want me to go into that. But, you know, it's prioritizing that service system is that, again, you have district hospitals, which have places for obstetricians, for ophthalmologists, for anesthetists. And there are many hospitals that have operating rooms. I would equip those hospitals and I would send obstetricians and I would send anesthetists over there to say that this is where the women should be brought for delivery. I would arrange for ambulances. When I say this, you know, there's a little thing at the back of my mind that all of these things have been done. You know, there is this USAID funded program called PIMAN, which ran from 2005 to 2011, worth $92 million. When, you know, oodles of ambulances were provided to the governments in all four provinces, and, you know, district hospitals were upgraded with shadowless lights and this, that, and the other. And now you find nothing over there. That is another discussion, the wisdom and folly of doing it in that fashion. The crux of the matter is that obstetricians and anesthetists will not go to these areas. They will not go live there because those areas are unlivable. They will not go and practice over there because they lose their private practice in the city. How difficult it is for the government to incentivize them. Do it for 6 months, do it for 6 years, rotate them around, and young doctors will kill each other to go work in those areas if they are assured that you will get to the top of the line for post-graduation.
Oops. Samia, you muted your mic, I think. Why is your mic muted?
I don't know. Khud hi ho gaya. Zyada baatein kar rahi hu na to isliye mute ho gaya. Can you hear me now? So without going into many details, Nadeem, because these are complex programs, but there are ways to do it. And there are a lot of people, you know, who are experienced and they need to be utilized. I mean, you look at what's happening now, just a handful of four people are making a health policy for a country of 22 million people with complex, horrendous, horrible problems.
Is there no public health policy research place? Anybody does any public health research? Anybody does any thinking on this area?
No, I don't think so. That's exactly what I said.
Health that we can find anywhere?
It's quite interesting because, you know, when I sit and talk with policymakers and with bureaucrats and with my technical experts, they say, well, no, when they have stopped blaming the previous government, they say, well, you know, we have a PC1 that we talk about our maternal health program and we talk about TB program and we talk about hospitals and we talk about this. You know, you take up any of these documents, and you look at that PC1, it's exactly the same PC1 that is turning over for the past 25 years. Whatever the government, every government says that they want to bring good quality services. Every government says they want to make people healthy. Why would they? Why would they not? But that.
So what, Samir, what has Bangladesh done differently then? Why is Bangladesh ahead of us? What is it?
Bangladesh is ahead of us because Bangladesh's policymakers actually put their kursis on the line, saying that we will do this in this area, in Kumela, in this. They took small geographical areas, you know, people who were elected from that areas, and they brought in technical expertise, which was indigenous, which was knowledgeable, which was experienced. And they incentivized them. They gave them, you know, good consulting salaries. They gave them authority. They gave them, you know, all of those things to design programs. And they then had these people work with implementing these programs with local governments. Like I say, you know, just a small gesture, like in one of the programs of the community health workers, I forget which district, they decided that the women were complaining of, because the supervisors got motorcycles to travel and also POL from the government. And these women who went from home to home to convince the parents to get their children polio vaccine had to walk, because the consideration was that homes are close by, so you can walk. And so these women complained. And of course, the local authorities bought these women bicycles. You know, just a small gesture that basically just changed the trajectory of the immunization program. So the point is that listening to people's problems, trying to solve their problems, and coming up with authority to solve those problems. You know, since I've been going into Kasur this past year extensively and talking in detail to, you know, people in various levels, you know, you find these poor vaccinators who are basically just chasing their monthly salary. Who's going to pay them? You know, it is going to come out of this budget. It is going to come out of that budget. And you know what? And these are poor people. You know, these are poor people. I have found the supervisor in one of the villages sitting. I went into one of the basic health units and this fellow was sitting under the tree. So I said, "Who are you?" He said, "I'm the supervisor." And he had a motorcycle standing right beside him. So I said, "You are supposed to be supervising. What are you doing over here?" He said that, "I don't have any gas. I don't have any petrol in my motorbike." So I said to him, "Ke koi baat, doesn't matter. Why don't you get it out of your pocket and then you can be reimbursed, I'm sure." He says, "I've been doing that for the past 3 months and I don't want to do that anymore." So then I spoke, you know, it's a kind of a detailed story, but small details are important in the lives of these people. I spoke to the medical officer. He says, "What can I do? You know, we have submitted our vouchers and the voucher has to go these many hurdles to God knows where."
He also said that the health budget is underutilized. So it's not as if money is not there. So the money is there.
The money is there. And Nandim, I haven't looked at the budget, health budget for this year. I did till about March, and till about March and April, the budget was about, 48% spent. I haven't looked at it since. So I don't know what the situation is this year, but you know, you pick up any year over the past 10 years. So it's not a question of this, that there isn't money in the system. I mean, it's just that nobody is in charge. Nobody is accountable. You know, nobody is answerable, and nobody is answerable to anybody.
Fascinating.
I was sitting in some
questions from the floor now. So let's see. Folks, raise your hands. Whoever wants to ask a question, I'll bring you in. Absolutely. Tell us what you think. Meanwhile, Samia, can you tell me, you say that the vaccination drive also is doing better in other countries, especially things like countries like Sri Lanka. Now, even Sri Lanka is doing better than us, and Bangladesh is doing better than us, and vaccination drive is better than us. So it seems to me, and our healthcare budgets are underutilized, seems to me it's a very large problem of mismanagement and lack of conceptualization of a system. Nobody seems to be committed to the health system. Nobody seems to care about the health system. Is that the correct approach, or is it something else? Is it an inability to do certain things?
I think that is one issue. And the other issue is also, I will say, and I don't want people to take it negatively, I am going to use the word competence. And it is, I use it in the sense of having the particular competencies that are required for the job, not as a negative thing, but you know, for every job. For example, I can drive a car, but I cannot drive a huge truck. I don't have the competency to drive that truck. So it is a lack of responsibility. You know, it is quite fascinating that there is all, the buck is always passed. You know, the health policy buck doesn't stop anywhere. Where does it stop? Not anywhere. So there is that issue that you have mentioned, but at the same time, there is very, very poor competence available in the health sector. When I was working for USAID, I worked very closely with the Federal Secretary of Health at that time. And I used to provoke him because I was representing US government and I was signing off on US budget to the government of Pakistan. So I had a little bit of power. So I would say to him that, you come up with a plan. Why don't you write a plan? Why don't you write your country strategy? And at one point, you know, he said to me, he said, The assumption was that USAID's strategy and USAID's plan should be implemented. And he said to me, he said, I don't have the expertise in my office. So why don't you go buy it? We as the donors will fund that consulting expertise. So but the donors are regulated in such a fashion, as you well know, that the first consultants will come from the country that is paying the money. So the government of Pakistan is forced to then hire consultants from United States because it is US government funding. So it is a very messy way that the system is organized. And Bangladesh was able to break that, and they were very successful. And Nadeem, actually, I've been while researching for this talk, I was trying to find out Bangladesh's health budget is about 2.5%, which is, you know, I suppose a little higher than Pakistan. But I Sri Lanka's the number that I get on the internet is 1.5%. And I was talking to people in the house. I said it's 1.5%, and everybody says no, that's not possible. It's got to be more because Sri Lanka does so well. So, you know, I don't know. So I would like people to correct me if 1.5% figure is wrong. But, you know, Sri Lanka is actually fascinating. When I went to Sri Lanka, I think it was year before last, the first thing that struck me as soon as you step out of the airport in Colombo, the first thing that strikes you is that there is no trash on the streets. I just couldn't get over that. I walked into little streets. I walked into, you know, back of restaurants and all of these places to find trash.
Yeah, it's clean.
You could not find uncovered trash anywhere.
Good point. Yeah. Let me bring in Talat Rizvi. Talat Rizvi? Ji. Can you hear me, Talat Rizvi?
Talat chali gayi.
No,
the mic was not on. The
host okay, good.
There you are.
Okay, I'm still here. Okay. First of all, I want to say thank you to Samia Altaf. She brought like five or six major issues or the policy guidelines for health within an hour. And each and every topic needs a discussion of more than 1 hour. To give you an example, you talked about the neonatal mortality rates. And we were discussing it in terms of COVID also. Now with the COVID emergency situation, no hospital or even the clinic are offering reproductive health services. So what will happen after 1 year? Will we have so many unwanted pregnancies? We'll have so many illegal abortions. We'll have so many mothers dying because they do not have access to the emergency obstetric care. We'll have so much domestic abuse where the women could not go out and report it. So this is what I'm saying, that each and every topic needs a separate discussion. If you want to do it in details.
We'll do
that.
And
then you talked, sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and then the second topic you talked about, you know, the healthcare system of community-based health system versus the formal health system and the community-based workers. I know these community health worker scheme, what we call them as lady health workers. If you look at the title of those lady health workers, it says lady health, the National Program for Lady Health Workers for Family Planning and Primary Health Care. They were supposed to provide family planning services door to door to our rural population and the primary health care to these women, the inaccessible, marginalized, poor people. But what happened that when the system was developed, and luckily it was, you know, well planned and it developed nicely. Whenever there was any situation, polio eradication, tuberculosis, or let's say ki jo koi ek MNA aa rahe hain to unko jhandi pakda ke khada kar diya, these poor girls were used for each and every other task which was not assigned to them. They had put so much pressure and so much load in their boat that their boat sank. So that is why our immunization was never up to the mark. And Pakistan is only one of the two countries which still has polio, Pakistan and Afghanistan, which is a shame. It's shameful. So this is another topic. We can have, so we know the issues and we know the solutions. We want to put it together in a policy guideline.
Great.
So each and every topic needs discussion.
Talat Bibi, come and help us. We will certainly do it. Inshallah, we'll get in touch with you. And
this is what I'm saying, that now we should sort of make a workforce or task force, and then we do an exercise of taking one topic at a time and do it very methodically and on a war footing ground.
We will try and do it, right? We'll bring you on board and we'll do it. Yusuf Niazi Saab, Samia, let me collect a few questions and I'll come back to you.
Sure.
Yusuf Niazi? Okay.
Hello?
Gigi, please go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Very informative. I've enjoyed the webinars every time they are on. I just want to ask Dr. Saiba a simple question. Does she see a role of a private sector anywhere in delivering healthcare in the system in Pakistan? And also, if she can touch upon the role of health insurance, if there is any, in her view.
Very good point. Alia Bibi? Alia?
Ji. Dr. Samia, thank you very much for a very inspirational talk. And my questions relate to, one is that there is a health services academy under the Ministry of Health in Islamabad, and it trained cadres of doctors in public health by awarding them masters in public health degrees. I know that because I used to go there and teach health economics at one point in my career. I just want to understand, have you interacted with any one of those doctors, and why public health did not get mainstreamed in the health system, health services systems in Pakistan? Because as COVID has demonstrated, our public health response, well, and you have also very clearly said, it leaves much to be desired. Second question is about a CDC, Center for Disease Control. Do you think that the present National Institute of Health has the capacity to be transformed into a CDC with the kind of epidemiological research that is required now post-COVID? So if you could just respond to these two questions. Thank you.
Mohammed Amin Saab? Mohammed Amin?
Assalamu alaikum, sir. Sir, awaz aa rahi hai, sir? सर मेरा क्वेश्चन ये है मैम से, मैं हेल्थ इकोनॉमिक्स का स्टूडेंट हूँ फोर्थ सेमेस्टर का सर। जैसे सर मैम ने बहुत अच्छी बातें की, लेकिन मेन मसला ये है सर, हमारे केपी में यहाँ पे जो है तो गवर्नमेंट डीएचए और आरएचए लेके आई है, लेकिन डॉक्टर्स ने जो है तो उनके अगेंस्ट 6 महीने स्ट्राइक किए, उसको जो है तो वापस कर दिया। आज मैं न्यूज़ में पढ़ा है ये लोग जो है तो एमटीआई एक्ट में इन्होंने अमेंडमेंट की है, आज ही खबर है। कि जो गवर्नर बॉडीज के रुकन होंगे वो जो है तो तकरीबन अपना अरसा कंप्लीट करेंगे, यानी एमटीआई में भी इन लोगों ने चेंजेस लेके आए हैं अभी तक। तो सर ये रिफॉर्म्स तो गवर्नमेंट भी ला रही है, लेकिन जब हमारा जो डॉक्टर्स है पैरामेडिक्स है वो जो है तो उसको एक्सेप्ट नहीं कर रहा। डीएचए सर डिस्ट्रिक्ट हेल्थ अथॉरिटी होगी, डिस्ट्रिक्ट लेवल पे जो है तो पावर ऑफ डेलीगेशन होगा, और रीजनल हेल्थ अथॉरिटी होगी सो डीजी हेल्थ से सब कुछ कट हो जाएगा सर। तो काइंडली सर इस साइड पे जो है तो बात होनी चाहिए सर।
समीर गो अहेड, द फ्लोर इज
योर। Let me take these starting with the first one. Mr. Niazi, you have raised very good issue that what about the role of the private sector and health insurance. You know, like I said in my earlier comments, that I have seen private sector. I'm not really a big believer of the handing over health services delivery to private sector unless you can regulate and monitor it very, very effectively. You know, I was part of the team in Washington DC Health Department when in the late 70s US health service industry moved towards managed care, which means that there were private companies that managed the care. They contracted with hospitals and doctors, and we, the government, paid them to provide the service. We set up very elaborate eligibility criteria. We set up the premiums for all of those, which were negotiated down to, you know, 5 cent levels, and we set up our own monitoring systems. Most of the states, I think out of 50 states, almost 35 states moved to managed care. And now after about 20 years, they have found that, you know, that system also did not deliver on the results. Because, you know, the it is very difficult to price this commodity for a consumer to buy from private companies when the consumer has no control over the shape and form and amount of this commodity. And if it doesn't work for you, you cannot return it back. You know, if you go to buy a car or go to buy shoes, you can do that. But when a consumer goes to buy healthcare, you know, they can't do that. Having said that, I do not rule out that there are certain areas in which, you know, private sector can contribute, but the responsibility of setting up regulations and monitoring that that service delivery and setting up eligibility criteria and the financial reimbursement rests with the government. And if the government, and I doubt very much that the Pakistan government can do it. This issue of health insurance, to me, I have written in last year when the previous Nawaz Sharif government also at some point, you will recall, started the health card. The same card was this health insurance scheme was started, and it started with, I think, 250 households and was expected to expand to God knows how many. And at that time, I'm on record saying that, you know, this kind of a thing cannot work in a country like Pakistan, where, you know, for to run a system like that, you need a very, very elaborate and a detailed health information system that gives you information for the needs of your clients and the service provided, so that the government should be able to monitor both ends of it and be able to reimburse people in these organizations in a timely manner. To me, it seems completely, should not be the first priority, because if you look at the extensive health system that government has developed, you know, all these health center, rural health centers and basic health units and the tehsil hospitals, this is basically a government financed system. So this is basically a health insurance scheme for the government. So I feel that that any scheme is good if you can do it well, if you can implement it well. If it remains only in theory, and you know, you grab here and you grab there, and after 5 years you say, okay, this was the fault of the previous government, now let's do some new improved thing, then of course, you know, that's that. My issue, I know about the Health Services Academy very well, and I was involved with it when I was working for USAID. I think USAID also funded it for a while. And my good friend Talat Rizvi, who is here, also was the director of the academy for a while. I have had the opportunity to interact with those doctors and talk to them. And, you know, they are smart, they are capable, and but, you know, where are they now? What are they doing? That comes back to the same utilization capacity of people that government, that get trained in Pakistan. I am sure, I'm just speculating, I don't know for sure, that I am sure that 50% of those doctors who trained through the Health Services Academy, if not more, have found jobs outside the country because, you know, they have acquired skills, which are good skills, and there is a market for them. And of course, you know, your government encourages this kind of exodus through the Ministry of Labor and Manpower that signs MOUs with the Middle Eastern countries to say we will supply so many people, you know, who are skilled people. And now the Ministry of Labor and Manpower is signing MOUs with countries like Japan. So the issue of mainstreaming of the public health is a very interesting and a long topic. Mainstreaming does not happen because public health is considered a field which is low on the professional totem pole. Because people in public health do not make money the way surgeons and cardiologists and radiologists make money, or obstetricians make money. They do not take, you know, life and death decisions for people, which is very dramatic. If you save the life of one woman who's dying of bleeding, you know, you become an obstetrician that everybody in the city talks about. But if you, as a public health person, my friend Talat Rizvi would know very well, you know, design programs and do training programs, at the traditional birth training program, that over a period of 6 months have to save the lives of 6,000 women, that doesn't figure anywhere, and that's not dramatic enough. And also because you don't have that credibility. This is not peculiar to Pakistan. This has been traditionally in this disease-based medical care system, which basically glorifies the treatment of disease. The more rare and the more exotic the disease is, and the more skilled you are in treating that, you know, that is. So this is also a very long discussion. Will say that, you know, and I will only say that. And traditionally in public health, those students, medical graduates went into public health who could not find positions in any other specialty. So that itself kind of stigmatizes the specialty. You know, when I switched from surgery, I had done a year's residency in surgery when I went to the United States. I had done a year's training in obstetrics and gynecology when I was working in Pakistan. So when I switched from surgery to public health residency training program, which was more rigorous than the surgical training program, it took 7 years. It had a academic degree and research work attached to it with degree that I did at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Even my own mother, even my teachers in Fatma Jinnah Medical College said to me, "What is your problem? Why did you go into public health? Tumhe to achhe bhale number milte the." So their assumption also was that if I was getting good enough, I was a good enough student and I got admitted into surgery, why would I leave surgery and go to public health? So unless public health is given that status and that credibility and that remunerative power that is attached to surgeons and radiologists, public health will not be mainstream. The issue of the present NIH capacity to transform into CDC, you know, any transformation can be done. You know, if the pupa can metamorphose into a butterfly, which is so beautiful and colorful. So transformation can be done, provided one is serious about transforming it. I mean, look at NIH. I go on to NIH website, you know, almost every week. I mean, there's nothing over there. They have no capacity. They have no skills. Even in their statement, they don't say what their mission is. They just say, we came into existence in 1965. So I really don't have very high hopes for NIH metamorphosing into a CDC. unless, you know, there is a serious plan. And again, like I said, that that plan is well thought out, that involves all the stakeholders, that is discussed the pros and the cons, and that has a budget attached to it. Ye to nahi, aisa to nahi hona chahiye that, you know, every 6 months or 8 months when the financial year is about to end, you know, NIH is chasing this donor or that donor to give them, you know, $100,000 or $200,000. No. I mean, you look at the NIH in the United States. I mean, look at the way it is funded by the federal government and the way it is funded by state government. So, you know, it can be done, provided somebody is serious to do it.
Samia, look, I appreciate all that you're saying, and I think this is absolutely correct. We have a penchant for copying everything done in the West, and we create a name and a label and an office with cars and houses for the people. But unfortunately, nothing happens. I mean, talk about Health Service Academy, we've also got a Judicial Academy, we've also got a Federal Reserve Academy, et cetera, et cetera. We've got tons of these things. But I want to ask a more fundamental question in closing before we go. I find healthcare very difficult to understand, Samia. I mean, the expectations are huge. And as I said, even the US is struggling with it. Even Europe is struggling with it. England, for example, one of the reasons that Boris Johnson came in is healthcare, is the national health. The key issue is, what do you mean by healthcare? And you talk about the private sector should not be involved, but if I take the Trumpian or the Republican view, healthcare is my personal responsibility. It's not anybody else's responsibility. If I don't eat right, if I don't exercise right, if I smoke, if I do all the wrong things, then obviously I'm going to be a burden on the healthcare system. So what kind of responsibility is it private? What kind of responsibility is it public? Secondly, the cost of healthcare is going up so rapidly. I mean, a day on the ventilator or a day on some of these fancy machines is a huge cost. These machines are getting more and more complex, more and more costly. Technology is improving more and more rapidly. The drugs, the prices of drugs, research is going up very rapidly. We've crossed the mark of the penicillin and the standard drugs. Now we are into very designer drugs, gene therapy, etc. This is going to be costly. This expectation that the government should provide everybody health insurance and the government should somehow take care of everybody, and there's no individual responsibility. Somehow I also feel uncomfortable with that, although I'm not totally on the Republican side. But I think there is a viewpoint there. What is individual care? What is private care? And then what kind of insurance can the government give? The government, if the cost of cancer treatment costs $1 million or $2-3 million, should the government guarantee that or not? So these are questions also. Can you shed some light on these?
Nadeem, I can try. I quite agree with you that, you know, the healthcare industry is a complex and a complicated industry which keeps changing. So it will not get everything right all the time. It will get a lot of things that it will muddle through. And I quite agree with you that a large portion of the responsibility rests with the individual. Let me give you the example of, you know, there has been this 30-year experiment in one field in public health, which is worth reviewing. It is very interesting how this cigarette smoking was reduced, because the health insurance companies in the United States refused to pay for cancer treatments for cigarette smokers. They refused to pay for emphysema treatment for people who were smokers. So there is a way to assign responsibility to individuals. But that too needs to be done into a larger framework of some coherent plan and some coherent conceptual understanding of where the government's responsibility lies and where the responsibility of the citizen lies. You know, pharmaceutical companies now, you know, and certainly in the United States, pharmaceutical companies are really, companies that make these devices. They are huge, you know, they fund political campaigns and they have lobbyists on Capitol Hill. But, you know, so I was a regular officer in the state government. You know, the states over there have a lot of power to, you know, I use this grandiose word for lack of any other, not because I want to, you know, say tout my own horn, but states have a lot of ability to bring these people to their knees to say that this is our legislation going to be going forward. We will only do this if you do this, we will only do. So there is, you know, if the government is serious and has a ability to think through their own problems and look at what they want done, what their objective is, how to do that in the interest of the citizens, I think these things can be solved and they can be done. I'm talking about the US experience, but you know, this, I'm sure it can't be transposed here in Pakistan, but I'm sure there are things one can do here in Pakistan also that can ultimately benefit the communities, and at the same time the individual can be made responsible also. Aap dekhiye ki in the public health program that was designed to decrease head injuries from automobile accidents, the use of the seatbelt. If you review that record over a period of 30 years, you know, it started with mothers against driving. These kids were driving without seatbelt. You know, consumers were punished. The industry was punished. There was policing. There was advertisement. There was communication. There was mass media campaigns. It was in schools, it was in colleges. And of course, you know, the states passed legislation at every stage, the states did regulation. And ultimately, they held the individual accountable. Yeah. It was ultimately the individual's responsibility to belt themselves in to prevent head injury. So to come to that stage where you can hold the individual responsible, you have to do the work. Because the individuals live in a society that is managed by a government.
Fair point. But I also have a feeling, Samia, that we create an unfair expectation on the part of the people. For example, right now in the COVID episode, what I hear is that it costs 100,000 rupees a day to go to hospital. It also costs 150,000 an injection for that, whatever, APC something drug. Right. So if you think about it, an average COVID patient would now cost something like, if it's even 5 days in hospital and two or three injections, it'll be 10 lakh rupees. Now, can the government guarantee that kind of money if it's going to offer insurance? Because I think insurance we offer cavalierly too. How much does treatment of a cancer or a heart attack cost? Can the government fund that if the government is offering insurance, or are we conning people?
Nadeem, one of the ways, I don't know about the Pakistan situation because I don't know what the costs are and what are the discussions they've had, but I'll share with you the experience I had in Washington, D.C. You know, government was able to fund all these high cost items and these high cost medicines by negotiating with the manufacturers and by negotiating with the providers that we will buy in bulk and we will buy a large volume from you. Okay? And we will give you tax breaks. So there is a way that the government, sovereign governments have a lot of power. I mean, come on. ये तो हम बाहर बैठ के सोच रहे हैं ना कि हम क्या करेंगे ये कहते हैं कि दिस थिंग कॉस्ट 150,000 रुपीस यू नो सॉवरेन गवर्नमेंट्स हैव अ लॉट ऑफ पावर ओवर इंडस्ट्री एंड दे कैन इंसेंटिवाइज द इंडस्ट्री एंड रिड्यूस द रेट्स टू एन एक्सटेंट वेयर दे आर मैनेजेबल फॉर द गवर्नमेंट विद सम काइंड ऑफ कोपे और सम प्रोपोर्शन ऑफ पेमेंट कमिंग फ्रॉम द इंडिविजुअल सो देयर आर मेनी वेज टू ट्वीक दिस फार्मूला टू मेक इट मैनेजेबल. It is a question of again bringing the competencies and the expertise, and you know, insurance in insurance programs. One of the expertise that is completely missing from Pakistan, because whenever I talk about somebody, and I had this opportunity to work with these actuaries and these statisticians who were very good at rate setting. So when you hand over a large population, you are handing over, and of course these insurance companies are businesses, they expect to make money, they expect to make a profit, and that is exactly how it should be, because they also generate economic activity, they give jobs to people. So these people are very expert at making it work for everybody. You know, what should the rate be that the government can pay without getting hurt very much? How much of that should be, you know, for administrative costs, or how much that should be for direct clinical costs? How can the pharmaceutical companies be made to feel that they are not losing out? So the government has the ability, the government has the power. But with that power, you should also have the ability and the competence to think through these issues and have the technical expertise at your disposal to do that. You know, when I was medical director of the DC Medicaid program, which is the health insurance program for poor people in the state, all I had to do was to call these GW rate setters. Of course, they cost, you know, $300 an hour because they were very... this is very sophisticated expertise, but you call them and they came and they did your work for you. And they, you know, so I didn't have to do it myself. No one person needs to know everything. But, you know, if you are in charge of getting something done, you should also know what are the components of this whole thing and what is the extra skill and extra competence that is needed to get this objective that I go for. So it can be easily done. I am very surprised, and I'm not surprised the injection is 150,000 rupees and the bed is 100,000, because most of the private hospitals are completely unregulated. Why should they not charge that? This is their one opportunity to do it. And the government hospitals, this is their one opportunity to be sneaky enough and try and extract something out of somebody's pocket. You know, the clerk does it. The person who gives you your my mother. I've just had this horrible experience of trying to get my mother's death certificate. You know, that person who's making out those death certificates, he is looking for those extra 5,000 rupees. So anybody who has a little bit of power to give you a bed or to give you an injection or to give you a this thing will use that power to extract from you.
Well, thank you very much, Samia. I think this has been wonderful. I think two or three takeaways that I've got. It points to the same old thing that we've almost got in every
sector. Nadeem, let me interrupt you here and say that I did not answer the question that was asked about the KP, District Health Authority, and stuff. I'm so, so sorry. I have been remiss, Muhammad Amin Saab, so forgive me. You know, I have been following this KP reform since it started. I do not know too many details because I've only been reading from what documents are available. And as I said, you know, documents are not very explanatory. But I do feel, in my view, I feel that this reform needed to be taken has not involved the stakeholder group in what needed to be done. Because in talking to colleagues in KP, it seems that there is a lot of confusion. People are very anxious and very unhappy and concerned as to what will happen to their future careers, what will happen to their jobs, what will happen to this, which are perfectly legitimate concerns. Most of these people are in their mid-level career paths. They have families to support. They have, you know, a lot of real life issues. So I will just say that because I really don't know too many details.
Okay, great. Well, Samia, I think the two or three key takeaways that I have is that like in every other system in the country, we seem to have very little thought in place. We seem to have very little ability to configure systemic thinking and to be able to work with systemic thinking, which is at the heart of policymaking. And we seem to have very little ability to negotiate and debate a long-term policy in any part of our country, unfortunately, any part, whether it's the healthcare system, whether it's the education system, whether it's the financial system, whether it's the human resource management system, all the systems seem to be suffering from the same problem, which is lack of thought, lack of architecture, lack of understanding. Also, in the same thing, I think in the same vein, we also seem to have very little research on these systems. And while we keep building things like the National Health Service Academy, like the NIH, and like the district health hospital units, and you know, whatever, BHUs and lady health workers, we seem to have very little ability or desire to run them. We make them and then forget about them. Very little desire to evaluate them, to monitor them and understand them. Our professionals are all frustrated and they tend to, you know, by and by, get frustrated, either leave the country or sit on the sidelines and worry. This is a systemic issue. I don't know how we're going to deal with it. We are trying to deal with it. Now, in healthcare, what I would request both you and Talat is to help us develop. I mean, PAD is a small organization, nothing great. We can't do much. But we're going to try and devote a little bit of effort to developing a health system research. We won't be able to do the kind of stuff that you want, but from the economic, social science perspective, administrative perspective, et cetera, we're going to try and do this. So We will request you people to help us think it through and at least begin to talk about a healthcare system somewhere. And we will also try and seek a collaboration with the Health Service Academy and the NIH to do that. And we'll talk to you about that too. So ladies and gentlemen, watch, think about it, help us develop a health system analysis, public health analysis in PID. Maybe that's a small seed that we can lay. And hopefully something will happen in the long term. In future, I'll get in touch with Talat as well. And Samia, you guide us if we can have any future webinars that might help. And I think this is one way that we can expand the debate in the country. Thank you. Sure. I appreciate your efforts and I appreciate everybody joining us. Thank you, folks. All the best. Khuda hafiz. Goodbye.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Pyde, for the opportunity.